Hi everyone, and a very warm welcome to this episode of the Learning Journeys podcast from Lacuna Learning. Thanks so much for listening and subscribing. I'm always surprised and pleased when I see how many people are listening in, so thanks so much for doing that. We hope you're all keeping really well. In today's episode, we are delighted to be joined by former world and European champion rower and now prisons manager for a brilliant programme called Boats Not Bars, Imogen Walsh. Imogen is a highly successful GB rower, having been a key member of the women's GB lightweight squad for a number of years. She medalled at world and European level, missing out on selection for the 2016 Olympic Games by the narrowest of margins. Originally from Inverness in the north of Scotland, Imogen has had such a cool journey so far, and more recently has done some great work international development in the Maldives, and as alluded to earlier, currently leads a programme using rowing to support the rehabilitation of offenders. So really keen to learn a bit more about that. I met Imogen, we were just laughing about this. In 2007, she had the misfortune to coach me and my doubles partner for a weekend at Faskelly in Pitlochry in Scotland. So she actually taught me a huge amount. A lot of actually what she taught me that weekend, I still think about in my rowing coaching.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I would, and it's just someone I've always kind of followed from a distance thereafter. And if I was to describe her, quiet, hardworking and humble are the main words I associate with Imogen. So delighted to have her along to share her journey. So thanks so much for your time, Imogen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we had a laugh about this before the pod started. If you could go on an adventure anywhere in the world, bearing mind you've travelled around most of the world, where would you go? Who would you go with?
And what would you do? This is really hard. I would love to go back up to Scotland and see my family. I would also love to go. I like going on kind of active adventures. There were some races last year that were cancelled, so ultra running events, and one was in Norway. I'd also love to go and do another adventure race, which is something I've done with a team of three guys and me. We'd love to go to like South America, maybe parts of Africa. I think the best way to discover new places is to do it on foot or kind of under your own steam. So more adventure racing, around the world, parts of the world that I haven't been to.
You totally hedged your bets, didn't you? And said, I'll just go to the whole world and have an adventure. No, that's cool.
Yeah.
But you did say you go to Scotland first, which is good.
Nothing beats home.
Yeah. No, if you're interested, go look at Imogen's Insta feed and stuff, and you'll see her crazy endurance races she did with people. Just looked like lots of fun, but just looked a bit brutal, actually.
It was amazing. And I think the most brutal part of it was the things like the sort of sleep deprivation and the psychological aspect of it. Once you get past a certain point, fitness will only get you so far. It's then like how you deal with the chronic discomfort, chronic pain, chronic sleep deprivation. But no, they're great.
Yeah, kind of interesting. Of course, spoken like a true elite athlete. Oh, the physical bit's fine. You just get on with it. Listen, at some point you've got to doing all the cool things you're doing now. Could you maybe just tell us a little bit about where it all started? You kind of said you grew up in Inverness. Where did sport begin for you and where did that kind of lead you?
So yeah, I grew up in Inverness. I would never, ever have been described as the sporty one at school. But I did kind of get involved in lots of sport. It's just because I liked the social element of it. I liked the fact that often it meant I could go travelling, which you mentioned earlier. I've always had a bit of a wanderlust. And then it wasn't until I went to Glasgow University, I started coxing, which for anyone that doesn't know rowing is the small person that steers the boat, because I'm quite small. I started doing that and then kind of decided actually it was much more fun to be sort of actually holding an oar instead. So started rowing what would be considered to be quite late. I would have been about 20 and I actually kind of started rowing myself, but even then did it in a very casual manner. What was still quite enjoying the party life, as you do as a student, and then graduated from uni, got a job, started rowing a bit more as a hobby, and really kind of kicked off when I was about mid-20s. That's when I first went, I think I was 26 when I first went to my first GB trial, which for a lot of people would be kind of coming towards the end of their rowing career, whereas it was, the start of mine.
You made me smile there as you're telling that story about starting at coxing. My wife likes to tell the story that she went the other way, started out rowing and then did a did a 5K test before Christmas in her first year at uni that was so bad and so slow that they'd never seen anyone do one so slowly that they asked her to maybe not do any more rowing and maybe do some coxing, which she was very happy about.
Wow, that's harsh. I mean, I mean, to be fair, my ergs were never my strong point, but I was too stubborn to move back to the coxswain seat. So.
Yeah, good on you. Yeah, I think my wife realised it was much more fun coxing, much more sociable, and you didn't have to do as much training, so it was good.
True.
I can't believe this, actually. I'm just thinking about this. This is like the second season of the pod, and you are the first rower I've had on the podcast, which I can't believe it's taken me so long to do this. It's great chatting rowing with people. I'm very aware we have an audience who aren't all rowers, though, so we need to just rowers, be careful with that a little bit. Anyway,
keep the rowing lingo down to a minimum.
We'll keep it to a minimum, yeah. And well, it's true, you make a great point. 26 was your first GB trials. I was forced to retire before then for medical reasons. So like at the point, you're right, when most people are stepping out of that kind of space, you were just stepping into it.
Yeah.
I'm dead interested, and we were chatting about this before. It wasn't this most straightforward of routes for you, was it? You made that sound quite easy there. Like you started rowing and then eventually you went off to join Team GB. What was your journey like to getting onto the team in the first place?
So I'm not naturally, or I wasn't anyway, not particularly strong. So to enter the GB trials, you have to have a minimum ergo standard. So for a lightweight woman, that's 7:28 to cover 2,000 metres. And I just couldn't get this for love nor money, despite the fact I would be able to beat people on the water who were going to trials. And it, to begin with, didn't bother me too much because it wasn't really on my radar to go and sort of try and row nationally. Like this was just my hobby. But as it continued, it started to irk me a bit. And basically, eventually, I managed to pull the ergo of exactly 7:28.0, which I swear they will think that I was pulling their leg. But legitimately, I pulled exactly the cutoff, which meant I could rock up to my first GB trial and found myself going actually somewhat better than I expected. I was actually driving back up to Glasgow from London. I was on the M6 and I got a call from Paul Thompson, who was the women in lightweight's head coach at the time, saying that I wouldn't do an Australian accent because that would be embarrassing. He's Australian. Imogen, would you fancy coming down and training with the team for a few days? At which point, sort of pulled off into a service station. I thought, oh God, what do I do? I mean, I'm meant to be at work on Monday morning. I've got a full-time job. But thought, well, this could be the once in a lifetime opportunity. So quick call to my boss, who I don't think was overly pleased at me suddenly taking 3 days annual leave, but it did it. Went back, trained with them for a few days. And that would have been February 2010. And by November 2010, I'd given up my job, left Glasgow where I was living at the time, moved to London in the hope of making it into the British team properly. So it all kind of went slowly, 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 and then very, very quickly in that 2010. And then by 2011, was my first international race, was actually the World Championships that year, which went off with a bang. It sort of rattled on from there.
You have predictably underplayed those 2011 World Champs, so we'll come back to that in a second. as I knew you would, it's great. I'm dead interested, Imogen. So you couldn't pull the ergo for love and money, as you put it. You just weren't strong enough. What was it that made you persist, like keep going and keep going? Because as the story as I remember it is that you couldn't pull the ergo, and you were like, I'll just carry on racing. You weren't training that hard compared to what they were doing full time. You then went and beat quite a lot of the girls who were already in the program, and that kind of led Great Britain to say, hang on a minute, what is going on here? How is she not pulling this arc but going so fast? So what was it that made you stick at it a bit longer?
I think, and this is something I think that needs to be embodied more in community sport in general, is that I just loved it. I loved both training and racing. I think some athletes love one or the other. And I love the grind of training, but I also love the adrenaline of sitting on the start line. And I think I actually perform at my best when I'm under pressure. So it was the love of racing love of training and racing that just kept me going. And then kind of having won quite a few sort of domestic events and there not really being anywhere else to go domestically, the next place for me to race people that were better than me was to go to British Trials. The only way for me to get there was to get the erg. So I just really kind of dug in. And I don't really know why I struggled with the erg for so long. Because then once I actually got onto the team, it wasn't terrible. Although I think I was always slightly marked as somebody that wasn't strong enough. And that's maybe something we get to later. But I mean, I then did eventually get my ERG score down to 707, which for a lightweight woman isn't terrible. But it was the drive just to do more of what I loved that I kept going. And I think once you lose that love, that's when things started to unravel a bit for me.
That's so interesting. I transitioned out of rowing into triathlon, and one of the things I observed was people in that sport, as you probably know, who just love the training, right? And the racing's almost an inconvenience to them at the end, right? They just love the training, particularly the Ironman fraternity. And they just love to get out there and do these crazy long sessions, but the racing, actually, they're not that big fan of. I was always more the opposite, that I quite enjoyed the training, but I didn't love it. I loved to race, to get out there and see how fast I could go. That was endlessly curious. And what you just kind of hit on there was, yeah, but you really need to love both, I think, to do this well. 2011 World Champs. I wasn't going to let you go that easily. They were your first world champs. You'd been racing, domestically and so on.
That was your first international race, even. Yeah.
What happened there?
So I was there in the women's lightweight quad. Like I say, I was completely new to the scene. I was so green. And two of the girls in the crew had been to world champs before, and there was one who'd done under 23s, and then me, who was completely new. So a bit unknown, but I mean, we knew we'd been going quite well in training, but it was all a bit. It was just exciting for me. I thought this may well be my only ever world champs and just, go out and enjoy it. And somehow we managed to go out and win it, and win it quite comfortably enough that in the last kind of 100 metres of the race, we actually knew that this was happening, that we were winning it and could just soak it all up and enjoy it. And it was incredible. I mean, for that to be your kind of first, that was my first race in kind of GB best. Thinking, wow, this is great. It's always going to be like this. Sadly, it's not always like that. But it was a pretty good way to start.
Yeah, I'm always interested to ask people who have that experience. I suppose most people live their lives waiting for that experience of waiting for the rest of the world to catch up with you as you cross the line first. But just give us a sense of what that was like for you, those last 100 metres. Obviously, international racing, it's never easy. You're always on it until the end, right?
Yeah.
What was it like in that last 100 coming into the finish?
The sort of realization that, oh my goodness, this is happening, but also, oh my goodness, if I let go of my oar handle and do what's called catching a crab, where your oar kind of catches the water. And it actually happened to, it was an Australian men's quad in that same World Championships. They were in the lead. I think one of them caught a crab, and they lost their win in like the last 10 meters or something. It was awful. So there's that element of really excited, but oh my God, just don't mess this up now. But yeah, it was fantastic. My parents had come out to watch. It was new to them as well. And in fact, my sister and her husband was there as well. And you kind of thinking of them there watching, and the cheers, the noise. Like, I love the noise of racing. That's something I love about racing, is the atmosphere and the kind of the energy that some people don't like it. I think the sound of it. I remember one girl I trained with, her perfect situation for doing a test on the rowing machine was in a silent room on her own. And that is my idea of hell. I want noise and people shouting and that kind of buzz. It gives me energy. And I remember it just being a beautiful sunny day crossing the line and thinking, let's keep doing this.
Oh, thanks. That was, just, I always want to ask people what that's like, having obviously never had that experience, that, what does it feel like? I'm going to tell a story now, which you won't remember, but because I'm going to ask you about the journey then from that point, 2011 through to Rio, I guess. I then saw you in 2012. You came up, no problems at all. It was yourself and Catherine and Heather came up to a Scottish rowing kind of junior development thing. And you walked in the room. I hadn't seen you for a few years. And I was about to say congratulations on winning the world champs. And before I got a word out, you said, oh, congratulations on getting married. And I was like, wow, there's someone with some self-awareness, right? That you're aware of who people are and what's going on around you. And it's sort of stuck with me, actually, that story, that moment. So,
thanks.
You're world champ, 2011.
Yeah.
Where did the journey go from there?
So from there, I kind of thought, when I went down to do that year, I thought maybe I'll just do a year rowing in the team and then go back to Glasgow, go back to Scotland and kind of carry on with life. But it's, as anyone probably who does sport knows, it's pretty addictive, especially when your first race is a win at the World Championships. And I just thought, this is great, carry on. So obviously 2012 was coming up. It wasn't really ever realistic to think I would make it into, for people that don't know, at the Olympics, there's 20-something seats for heavyweight women. There's two seats for lightweight women. So you might see a lot of women rowing at the Olympics. Unfortunately, only two of those seats are available to someone of my size. So it wasn't realistic to think I was going to get into the London 2012 squad. However, I was actually in like the second boat that year. So it's a double that goes to the Olympics. And then I was in like the backup double, I guess, that year. And things were going well. Went through 2012. Obviously, 2012 was a fantastic year for lightweight women. They got gold at the Olympics, Sophie and Kat. And then I just felt that I was progressing. I was actually getting faster on the erg and learning things that I just never, concepts about rowing that I'd never really heard before. And then, yeah, continued on in the hope of, I don't know if I ever really truly believed I'd make it to Rio, but I wanted to. And then was in the boat, in the double, which was the Olympic class boat, for a couple of years before it all sort of went a little bit pear-shaped in 2014, 2015.
Yeah, I sensed a tinge of regret there and what might have been. Going into 2016, it was a near miss. Can you tell us about that?
So, yeah, I was in the double for a couple of years. I love the grind of training, so I'm never one to say, you know what, I'm hanging here. I need a bit of rest. We had a really good season coming into the 2014 World Champs. We won, there's a World Cup series. We won those, and then going to the World Champs, kind of, as you would imagine, one of the favourites. Anyway, we had a diabolical semi-final. It just unraveled. It makes my stomach churn thinking about it. It just fell apart. We came fourth. So we were in the B final. So any hope of it was all gone. We raced the B final. We won the B final. We actually set a world best time in the B final, but it was completely, it didn't matter. So coming out of that, there was a kind of greater emphasis. Okay, what went wrong and what can we make better? I was small. I was under, there is a weight limit for lightweights, and normally lightweights sit slightly above it and then come down to that weight for racing. I would consistently sit under it, quite comfortably under it. So one of the things that could be done was I could put on more muscle. I had the capacity, the weight allowance to do it. So I was given kind of extra training, and being the kind of person that just laps that up, I did, despite the fact that my scores actually started getting worse. I was getting slower. It felt like I was rowing through treacle. It was observed that that's kind of just didn't look right. And erg scores, erg being the rowing machine, getting slower. And eventually, I just ached all the time. Eventually, I was pulled out of training and actually out of training from October till the following kind of spring, with overtraining, oxidative stress, REDS, all the problems that you associate with overtraining. And although I came back in that season in my single, which nobody thought I would, race Worlds in my single that year, it was never enough to get back into the double that went to Rio. So it's, I don't regret, if somebody says, it gives me a training session, I will do it. And I put my faith in people. And unfortunately, I think I should have put a little bit of faith in myself that when I wasn't feeling right, that I was genuinely, it wasn't, I was being lazy and I wanted to have an off day. Like, it was actually that I was really getting quite ill and not actually believing myself. I think self-critique can be a fantastic motivator. And I think that's a lot of how I got from the girl at uni who couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding to in the squad. It was that constant, like, come on, Imogen, you can do better. That got me there. And so I don't want to take that away from my character. But it's also what I think led to my downfall was keeping pushing even when things were telling me that I shouldn't. And that's kind of when I think you need somebody there who's outside, who knows you and can say, look, now actually you need to stop. Who knows what's best for you? Because I think you get so clouded in that goal that you can't see the wood for the trees anymore. You can't see what's best for you. And I got to that stage where I actually was just sort of wasn't enjoying it anymore. And that's, I'd lost the love and I was just plowing through each day, not enjoying it, not getting any faster.
Oh, thanks, Imogen. I feel that real like sadness and I kind of, I guess from the outside wondered what had gone on there. It's really interesting to hear that. What struck me most there was you kind of highlighting this idea that what I guess had been your greatest strength, which ability to just get the work done, get on with it, be very single-minded and determined, was also the thing that was kind of your undoing a little bit, that it led you to kind of blindly keep going, expecting or hoping for a return that then didn't come and actually left you, it sounds like, pretty unwell, actually.
Unfortunately, I've done it to myself again. I've recently torn my hamstring tendon off the bone by continually running on tendonitis. Unfortunately, I haven't learned my lesson yet. Hopefully this time I will learn it. But yeah, I think it's one of the things that's made me understand more about what sport can do for you, though. And used correctly, it can be a huge kind of motivator in your life, but it can also be detrimental if it becomes your only piece of self-identity. Because when those numbers start to fall, you fall with it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point, isn't it? And it's being spoken about a lot. A lot of athletes are talking about this now, that this idea of your identity being wrapped up in your success as an athlete, and that in some ways being good, but then later on that can lead us into some not helpful places. Mm-hmm. I'm also really grateful that you highlighted some of the overtraining syndromes, some of the red stuff that I know is getting more and more press. I think it's really good that people talk about that. Mm. It's not all doom and gloom, right?
No.
And then an opportunity came along, didn't it? It came knocking. What happened next?
What, which one? The post-2016 one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I finished out my own rowing career, not in the Olympic boat, but in a non-Olympic boat. Actually went there, had a year in my single, a year in the quad again with some fantastic girls who are now like such good friends and will be. And it was such a positive way to end what had become quite a unpleasant time for me. But it was, I'm so grateful that I had those girls to row with. They were just absolutely cracking. So 2016 came around and I didn't know quite whether I wanted to carry on rowing, or because I felt I still had some kind of unfinished business, but also feeling I really just needed a bit of a step away from it and clear my head a bit, because it is a pressure cooker of a kind of situation to be in for 5 years. But I was offered a role to develop the Maldives rowing program. So, well, hard to say no. So I went, I left sort of a matter of weeks after World Champs in 2016 and went out there for 7 months and worked in their program. Before I rowed, I worked for an international development charity, and then obviously had rowed for 5 years, and this was in some way I felt a bit of a crossover between the two. And the idea was to develop the rowing program in the Maldives, both a kind of high performance stream and also a broader kind of community participation program. And it was a fantastic opportunity. A lot of learning on my part to understand the culture and fit the rowing into it, rather than go with a rowing program and just slap it on the culture. And like, it doesn't work like that. You have to work with what the environment is in order for people to engage with it. And I think I was probably naive in going, well, not probably, I was naive in going and just trying to have a sort of black and white, this is what we're going to do because this is going to get the results, which it would get results, but it's not going to get results if it's not appropriate for the environment and therefore nobody's going to do it. So that was a kind of learning process, really interesting. And then, 7 months there, came back to the UK, kind of feeling like I want to do something in sport because sport has given me so much and I know what it does for my psyche. Wasn't quite sure how, in what format to take that. So I kind of considered going to high performance coaching, or coaching with the hope of going high performance, and tried that out for a while at various different clubs around the UK. But really found that what I got a buzz out of wasn't so much helping somebody go faster in a boat, which is great, but was about people growing in confidence through that process, and people communicating better, and people just being happier because they're getting out in a boat and challenging themselves and doing things that they didn't think they could do previously. And it was that kind of psychological side of it that actually really kind of I'm interested in, as opposed to the technical rowing side of it as such, which is what's led me to doing what I'm doing now.
Oh, well, I feel like we've reached a much happier place than we were, but I'm really glad we lead into that kind of pain and regret and all the things that came with that. And then this, 7 months in the Maldives just sounds rubbish, doesn't it? But I love what you said there about you have to work with the environment. You can't impose what you want to do, and it's got to be the right fit. Ben Ryan talked about this when he went to Fiji to work there with the Rugby Sevens team, that he had lots of ideas that were going to help them, but they did win the Olympics in 2016. but the ideas that would have been second nature in England were just not going to work. He had to very carefully work with that environment. I thought it was really interesting. You've also just kind of beautifully described, I guess, my own philosophy about rowing coaching. So I coach teenagers primarily. I see it as a vehicle through which to develop young people and also fast rowers, but it is that way around for me. And I have people that I work with who think the other way around, and that's fine. That's okay as well. But for me, I've just always seen it as a vehicle through which to develop young people. And that's I'm kind of with you on that one. That's why I stand around in the dark in the middle of winter, normally cycling around getting cold and wet. So the current project, can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so it's basically, I now go into prisons and run rowing programs with a view to reducing reoffending rates when those people come out of prisons. So there are various sports programs that operate in prisons, football, rugby, cricket, ping pong. And so in some sense, rowing is like those in that it has all the same attributes of engaging in physical activity every day, has positive mental health benefits. The other thing I think rowing has that it is really alien. I mean, to the majority of the population, the idea of doing rowing is a bit out there. And why would I do that? That's not for me kind of thing. And therefore, I think it has an extra kind of power in that it challenges their sense of participant's sense of kind of self-image. And it is a bit daunting to do something that you've never done before. And I think that's only when you start to challenge your comfort zone that you really start to grow. And if you think of like confidence being like a muscle, you know, you go to the gym and you lift weights to kind of break down the muscle to make it stronger, and your confidence is just the same. So I became friends with a guy called John McAvoy, who was a former armed robber. Some of you may know of his story, incredible story. He was the only youth category AA offender in the UK. He was on Britain's top 10 most wanted list. I think at a young age, he was in Belmarsh High Security Prison in a cell next to Abu Hamza. He was a prolific criminal. And in prison, he started using the rowing machine, found he was very good at it, broke a load of world records in prison, and then was released, came and joined the rowing club that I was rowing at the time, London Rowing Club, which I joined when I moved from Scotland to follow my own rowing. And after a while, he told his story, and it was kind of inspired by him and his story, and of my own feelings of what sport can do, that I, a year and a half, 2 years ago, approached Fulham Reach Boat Club, which is a community boat club with the view of engaging more people in the sport, sort of increasing diversity, breaking that image of rowing being an elitist sport, but really opening up to anyone and everyone in the community, and spoke to them about launching a project with offenders. And they were keen on it. So we started a project at Feltham Young Offenders Institute, pilot project, which went well. And then in October 2019, we launched in five prisons around the London area, where I would go into each prison once a week and have other sessions coached by prison staff. And then those that were eligible to come out on what's called ROTL, release on temporary license, I could take them out onto the river for a day, which was just such, you could see the kind of the effect on the people that do that, oh God, I never thought I'd be able to do something like this. And it's that challenging their kind of perception of what they think they can do. And it opens your mind to things like, to some extent, that was what I got when I first went down to a trial, GB trials, and then it was opened up to me, well, maybe you could do a bit more. And that never occurred to me really, but it takes somebody to say, why don't you try this? And all of a sudden you go, well, okay. And then you find that you can. So yeah. October 2019, operating in five prisons. Obviously, COVID struck 6 months after that. So we're still, although it's been going for a while, there's obviously been a kind of year lull where I've been in prisons, out of prisons, as and when lockdown allows. But we continue on. We have now people who have gone through the program in prison, who have been released during the pandemic, and are now members of the club. Fantastic. I mean, they give such energy. Like, it's not I think people could see this as like a charitable kind of thing, but actually it's helping somebody, but they help us too. We all benefit. I find their story hugely inspirational. One of our guys coaches online circuit sessions to other members, and they all absolutely love him. And it's just such a brilliant story of what can be done with the power of sport. Getting somebody into a club where they've got this really positive peer group, and they value you because you train hard, and you know, it's not, you're not being valued because of your what you can do criminally, it's valued because you can do so many burpees. What's purer than that? I mean, it's a bit, but you know, it's great. Hopefully we can, once I get back into prisons again, we can keep this going, getting more people coming out of prison and into clubs, whether that's Fulham Reach Boat Club or other clubs that are nearer them.
I mean, I don't know about the listeners, but I got sort of slightly chills hearing Imogen talking with that passion about that. I mean, you want impact, you've got people released from prison who are now club members, who are now coaching sessions, like people like making really positive contributions to, to the sport and society much more widely. That's incredible. I love what you said there. What can be done with the power of sport? Just, I couldn't agree more. And it was, I'd kind of seen it floating around the ether of social media, and I'm so glad you sort of told us a bit more about it.
I think often some people would think, well, they've done something wrong, they don't deserve opportunities in prison. My feeling is absolutely people who are in prison, by and large, they have done something wrong, and that's, so yes, they should be, something done. But they've often done something wrong because they've been in a horrific situation that I know I've been lucky. I've never been in that situation where I literally don't know how I'm going to feed myself, or not even myself, feed me and my younger brother and sister, for instance, at the age of 16, 17, 18. If I'd been in that position, maybe I'd have done something like that too. People that are in prison, yes, they have chosen to do what they've done, but from a very limited range of choices. And I think that's the thing that is often missed, that I see a much wider range of choices maybe in my life than some people may see in their life. So the people that I work with, I think, deserve the help because they haven't had the help first time round maybe. So give them an opportunity. And if you want to, and I hate talking about it in purely economic terms, but if you want to look at it that way, supporting somebody to take part in a sport or music or an education program, whatever it is that engages them, if that keeps them out of prison, then that's also better for the public purse. But I mean, I think morally on its own it is enough to justify it, but financially, economically, it's a no-brainer as well.
Oh yeah, totally. Anna, I'm with you. We don't want to reduce it down to those kind of terms, do we? But you're absolutely right. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try and summarise this a little bit, this conversation. I'm going to ask you one final question at the end, but I'm just so grateful to you for your time. It's been incredible to listen to this. And we could undoubtedly carry on. We might have to get you back for episode 2, maybe. I don't know. Started out, I love that, not the sporty kid, and look what you went on to achieve. And, you know, I recognise that, you know, I wouldn't have been considered a sporty kid either, and they'd be surprised I now work in sport. But it's interesting how those labels start young, but they don't always persist, right? I love you said that when you got that, went through an unusual route to get into the GB program, and then this idea of this could be my once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and you kind of recognised that and said, okay, I'm going to sack off work for 3 days and see where that goes and go with that. This idea of, to be really successful, you've got to love the training and the racing. You can't just love one of them. It's going to go. And that thing later on, when that love of it goes, that's when we start having problems and things not being so good. This idea of identity is really important as athletes, but if that becomes, our success becomes who we are, then that can be quite a dangerous place. And then just this bit at the end, we've talked about this Boats Not Bars program then at Fulham Reach Boat Club. Yeah, just, I love that idea. Rowing's really alien to a lot of the population, so if you give them that, it can quite challenge their self-image. I thought that was really interesting. And just, the what can be done with the power of sport. So given your incredible career, I'm going to ask you a big question, which is, if you could have a wish for sport, something that you wish sport could have more of or have less of, or could be different or improved in some way, given everything you've been through, from messing around in boats and having a great old time to elite level success to international development, everything in between, what would be your wish for sport?
I think I start off by saying there's obviously a place for high performance sport where you are driven by metrics, like you have to hit certain speeds and so on. But even at that level, but especially more so at a kind of community participation level, we have to just learn to enjoy it more. And I don't know if it's even down to not calling it sport, but just calling it activity. It's just being active. I mean, something that I've loved about lockdown is seeing so many more parents going out cycling with their kids, or they're running and the kids cycling, and just people being active together and enjoying it together, enjoy being outside. And there's a lot of pressure for gyms to open up so people can get back into gyms. I think that's great as long as people are actually enjoying what they do at the gym. Because you're never going to embed a habit if it's, I have to go to the gym and I have to do 40 minutes on this many watts. And I mean, well, some people might enjoy that, but I think by and large, it's more of a social thing that people want from it. And that's what we've seen with a lot of kind of online training kind of groups now happening. People miss training together and exercising together and being in the outdoors. And I think more of a focus on enjoyment. And that there is also a place for competition. Don't get me wrong. I love competition. I am super competitive. And that should always be an outlet for those that want it. But more broadly, I think, yeah, it just needs to be about fun and activity and not stressing about the results. And then if you want to go on and race, pin that number on. I mean, it gives me like goosebumps thinking about just pinning a number on. I love racing. But there has to be. It sounds a bit fluffy, but there has to be enjoyment there.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that's a really nice pausing point, isn't it, in this conversation? Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I stepped away from my amateur sport career, I guess, when it started feeling like another day in the office. But it was like, I just feel like I'm going through the motions here. Like, I'm not really enjoying this anymore. I'm doing it because I want to get to an outcome. And then I stepped away. And now I'm back doing some sport again, some running and some climbing and things like that. I'm just enjoying it. It's fun. And so that...
Yeah. And you'll get better results from it. I think it's sometimes thought that in order to get results, you can just take it seriously. And I just disagree with that. I think you will get better results if you're enjoying it. So trying to get that into the competition, not replacing it with competition.
Listen, I predict that our listeners will be extremely interested to learn more about you and to maybe follow you and see where you're at. Where can we follow you, social media, etc.?
So fulhamreachboatclub.com is a website for information about boats and bars. I'm on Twitter, I think, at Imogen Walsh, and on Instagram at Imogen Kate. But I think you'll be able to, because some of those spellings are a bit quirky, I think you'll put them up in the programme notes if you're really keen to follow what I'm up to. Can't promise that all my tweets will be super highbrow, but some of them might be interesting.
I will stick those in the description, yeah. And do give her a follow. Just an amazing person, lots of really cool things, and she's always up to something. So I'm always like, I wonder what Imogen's up to right now. That'd be cool. Thank you so much for your time. Everyone, thanks for listening. Do keep an eye out for future podcasts. Hit subscribe to never miss out. And obviously, everyone, for now, please stay safe.